The Aspire podcast series has been developed by Sheffield Hallam University Aspire Scholars as a resource to support students on their career development journey. The Aspire programme is dedicated to eradicating structural racism in higher education, working collaboratively with institutions to implement policy changes that promote diversity and combat bias. By amplifying the voice of Black scholars, the programme aims to enrich the academic community with diverse perspectives and, in doing so, strengthen the foundation of knowledge for generations to come. Aspire is more than a programme, it is a catalyst for change, a path to excellence and a promise of a more inclusive tomorrow.
Hi and welcome to the next episode of the Aspire podcast. Today I am joined by Peter Olushaga. Peter, welcome to the podcast. Tell our listeners about yourself.
I am a senior lecturer in psychology. And my research interests are all around stress and burnout and well-being in high-performance environments, so in particular the sport environment, and specifically with high-performance sports coaches, so all about their well-being, how they might avoid burnout, deal with stress, and look after themselves a little bit more.
And today's episode is very much aligned, obviously, to your background and your expertise. And the focus for today is about imposter syndrome. We're going to talk a little bit about mental health and well-being and also self-care. So just to kick us off, Peter, imposter syndrome is something that is often talked about. Could you explain to us what we mean by imposter syndrome?
Yeah, sure. So back in the late 70s, a couple of researchers defined imposter syndrome. This was Pauline Rose Clance and Suzanne Imes, defined imposter syndrome as the condition of feeling anxious and not experiencing success internally, despite being high performing in external objective ways. So basically what we're saying is, even if we're objectively good at something by any kind of external measure, imposter syndrome means that we have difficulty accepting that, and we feel like maybe we're almost a bit of a fraud. So people tend to doubt their abilities, and there's this almost kind of constant feeling like you're going to get caught out or discovered, that you're not all you're cracked up to be. And it's funny because imposter syndrome is particularly prevalent in marginalized groups and also in early career academics.
So you mentioned there about the feeling of being caught out, but what other feelings might somebody who's going through imposter syndrome be experiencing?
Well, there's that ongoing sense of dread, almost, like I said, about being found out, like almost it's going to be revealed that you're an imposter, and you know, somebody's going to discover that you've got no idea what you're doing. And that brings with it a lot of anxiety. So people experiencing imposter syndrome will often undervalue their own contributions to a piece of work or to a project. They'll attribute success to external factors. So, I mean, I'll give you an example, because I experience imposter syndrome all the time. You know, I've got a PhD, I've been teaching for 15 years, I've got a pretty decent publication record. But as somebody who has a deep sense of imposter syndrome, I often frame this fairly objective level of achievement as being down to luck. So, you know, I'll say that I sort of drifted my way to a 2-1 as an undergraduate. I was lucky to be in a position to be offered a chance to do a PhD. And I very much undervalue my own my own sort of effort and work into being in those positions. So, you know, that brings that sort of sense of anxiety about being found out. But there's also a sense of comparing yourself to other people. Like, everybody else is working really hard, everybody else is good at what they do, so you're left with this feeling that you're almost kind of just winging it. So there's that sort of anxiety about being found out, but there's also that sort of impact on your confidence as well, that everybody else is kind of knows what they're doing, and I'm just sort of, you know, I'm just basically just winging this.
And basically, it is something that a lot, if not everyone, goes through at some point, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Like I say, you know, I would consider myself to be a fairly established academic, and imposter syndrome is something that I deal with. So it's a perfectly normal thing to experience. But yeah, there's that sort of anxiety, that sense of dread, that sort of lack of confidence that comes up sometimes.
So what are some of the things that our listeners could do to kind of overcome imposter syndrome or manage it? Because they are likely to all be very early on in their careers. Mm. I know the minute that an academic says to a student, you've got to do a presentation, that there's the, you know, the fear comes out. So what steps could listeners take to kind of move forward confidently?
Well, one of the things that's really important here is to think about where imposter syndrome comes from. It's really easy to think of imposter syndrome as a problem that the individual has to overcome, something that's, you know, within the individual that they have to do something about. And, you know, really, imposter syndrome, along with all of that, that fear of failure, the self-doubt, those maybe limitations that we place on ourselves, we have to look at them as being a perfectly rational response to an environment or a system that's really kind of designed to make us feel a little bit inadequate. So by that, I mean, you know, the environments that we work in, and academia is absolutely one of those environments. It's a place where there are often irrational, often unrealistic expectations placed on us. So, you know, I'll give you some examples. In academia, workload and kind of the tasks that we're given aren't necessarily representative of the time that we're given to do them. You know, we're dealing with job insecurity, precarious contracts, lack of recognition, unrealistic expectations. So all of these things create this environment where it's actually perfectly normal to feel a little bit like an imposter. And I know I'm kind of getting away from the sort of fairly simple example of giving a presentation, but this will become important in a moment, I promise. Mm-hmm. It's really sort of prevalent in academia to say, to kind of talk about all of the good things that we've done. Here's another paper that I've written. Here's another presentation that I've given to such and such a group. Hey, look at me working with this team, or look at me, you know, giving this keynote lecture. It's a environment where we are very much driven to show all of the good things that we're doing. Okay, it's much harder to recall instances of people saying, you know, my paper's been rejected for the fourth time, and putting that all over social media. It just doesn't really happen. And we've got a broader culture here of overwork as well. So a culture that rewards performative productivity, right? You know, you only need to go on social media to find 100 videos telling you that you have to get up early, you have to sacrifice sleep, you have to work all the hours that, you know, of the day just to get ahead. So we celebrate burnout, we celebrate overwork. So recognizing this culture for what it is, and recognizing that you know, we are in this culture of sort of overwork and burnout, that's one of the most important things that we can do to get past this idea that you're an imposter. Because you're really not. It's the system that is creating this environment that makes you feel a little bit sort of inadequate, that makes you feel like you're not good enough, that makes you feel like you can't do these things. So recognizing that it's a systemic problem, not an individual one, is really the first step to tackling it, to dealing with it. Now, in terms of some of the sort of specific things that the individuals might do, like obviously there are some important things here. So, you know, you gave the example of doing a presentation, what somebody might do to sort of get over some of the nerves maybe of giving a presentation. A couple of things. I mean, confidence comes from looking at things that we've actually done, our past achievements. So while imposter syndrome might tell us to maybe play down some of those achievements, it's really difficult to ignore a ton of evidence. So, you know, keeping a log or a journal of successes, milestones, achievements makes for a really good resource. And it's something that people can refer back to. You know, you can remind yourself that actually, you know, you're pretty good at this. You're pretty great. I think maybe practicing mindful awareness and acceptance of some of those unhelpful imposter syndrome type thoughts as well can be helpful. So just the act of noticing that your mind is giving you unhelpful thoughts, and just kind of allowing it to do that, knowing that thoughts are just thoughts, they're not necessarily the truth. And that's often better than trying to battle against them or kind of get rid of them. it's something that takes practice. You know, it's not something that's easy to do, but there are a couple of things I think that people can do to maybe sort of battle that imposter syndrome a little bit.
I liked what you said there around your mind giving you unhelpful thoughts, because that is what it is. It's not a weakness, is it?
Absolutely, yeah. It's definitely not a weakness, and it's kind of just what minds do, really. You know, we're constantly bombarded. Our minds are constantly giving us all of these thoughts. Some of them are helpful and some of them are less helpful. Mm. And if we can kind of recognize that that's just what our mind is doing, you know, our thoughts aren't the truth. We don't have to accept them as the truth. And again, looking at that actual evidence, well, there are plenty of times when I've been able to stand up and talk confidently in front of people. There was plenty of times when I've given a presentation, I look at my body of work, you know, I've got good grades and this, that, and the other. So if you're looking at the actual evidence, then we can see that our thoughts aren't necessarily the truth. So just kind of accepting that they're there, because, you know, we spend a lot of time fighting against them and kind of trying to get rid of them. And just the act of doing that and the energy that it takes to do that can actually just lead to more stress. So being kind of accepting, and like I say, it takes a lot of practice, but just being kind of a little bit more accepting of, okay, well, that's just what my mind's doing. It's giving me these thoughts. I don't have to believe them. And actually, if I look at the evidence, you know, I'm pretty good. So can I kind of commit to doing the thing that I want to do anyway, which is to walk into that room and, you know, give a good account of myself and look like I'm confident and kind of say the things that I want to say.
So I want to talk through an example or a scenario that I think most of us have been through and many of our listeners will be going through. Mm-hmm. So a student successfully got through the application process for a job and has been invited to an interview. The interview day arrives and then they're sitting thinking, oh my God, I'm questioning my abilities. Am I suitable for the job? Why did they pick me? I must have got through by mistake. How does somebody deal with those feelings so that they are still able to produce a positive interview so it doesn't eat them up?
Yeah. Well, I think the things that we just talked about are important here as well. Mm-hmm. So again, going back to keeping a list of your achievements, a list of things that you've done that you're good at, so that, you know, having that evidence there so that when those unhelpful thoughts do crop up, because they will crop up, you know, we can refer back to that. Okay, well, here's a list of things. Here's all of the reasons why I'm awesome. Okay. And again, sort of seeing those thoughts as thoughts. But another strategy that might be important here is to think about what success really means in that situation. So is success, for example, being offered the role? Maybe success, maybe we can reframe that. Maybe success is actually just making a good account of yourself in the interview. Perhaps it's, you know, perhaps a successful interview is one where you speak clearly and give concise answers. Maybe it's just about looking like you're confident, you know, walking into the room as if you own it and giving the impression that you're confident. Maybe that is success. You know, breaking down what success looks like in that situation, focusing less on the overall outcome, that takes away a little bit of that anxiety. And not only does it take away some of that anxiety, it helps you to focus in on the things that you actually can control. So I can't control whether I'm going to be offered the role or not in an interview. What I can control is, have I practiced my presentation or whatever it is going to be? Have I anticipated some of the questions and have I practiced giving my answers to those questions? Have I spoken them out loud? You know, all of those small things that you can control in that situation. Can we focus in on them a little bit? And if I execute them the way that I want to, maybe that's success. And the outcome, maybe I can let go of that outcome a little bit. I mean, it's easier said than done when there's a job on the line. But if we can do that, it does remove a lot of that anxiety and some of those unhelpful, anxious type thoughts.
And I think, as you mentioned earlier, there's a lot of external pressures as well now, particularly from social media, in terms of, you know, we mm-hmm. know this whole narrative around presenting a really positive view of your life when actually it might not be. It's all the pressures of how you should and shouldn't be, yeah. Which can actually then create further anxiety, burnout, you know, you kind of run down. So how important is it for us to kind of involve self-care as part of our daily routines, particularly around our well-being?
I think self-care is part of the well-being puzzle. I know I keep saying the same thing here, but it is really important to remember that this imposter syndrome is a systems problem, an environment problem, rather than an individual one. Mm-hmm. So self-care is important, but it's important to practice self-care with the recognition that it's not necessarily down to the individual to fix the issue. So self-care is great for treating the symptoms, but not necessarily the causes. The reason why that's important to remember is because it's really easy for me to sit here and say things like, yeah, practice self-care, make sure that you set boundaries. Setting boundaries is a brilliant thing, you know, like not answering emails out of office hours or at weekends. You know, it's a great self-care strategy to set boundaries like that. But if you're in an environment where you're receiving emails from supervisors or from senior members of staff at those, you know, out of our office times, then your self-care strategy becomes much more difficult because there's that expectation placed on you by the system. You know, same with, oh, you should say no more often. You should say no to things, you know. In theory, that's great, but I have to recognize that, you know, as a supervisor or, you know, as a senior member of staff, I can't advise young researchers to say no more, you know, and kind of protect their time while I'm also telling them that, well, you need to be doing this and you need to do that and you need to do this other thing in order to kind of get ahead in your career. So, you know, I have to be aware, we have to be aware that self-care is important, but it's also done within an environment that sometimes makes it more difficult. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that we shouldn't practice self-care. That's not to say that it's not important. I think one of the really perhaps foundational elements of self-care is to think about what is truly, honestly important to you. Like, what do you really value? But in domains other than work. Work can be kind of part of that. But, you know, what's really important to you in terms of family, in terms of health? What's important to you in terms of relationships, personal growth, you know, having fun? And for me, that this kind of foundational element of self-care is about making sure that you're taking the time to look after and take action that moves you towards what's important to you in all of those different areas, not just work, you know, not just one of them. Because I think if we focus on one of those areas, like let's say we, you know, focus on work and what we really value in work and we're constantly moving towards that, that's great when work is going well. But when things start to not go so well, you know, we're not really left with anything else. So it's about, you know, thinking about your identity as a whole, other elements of your identity apart from work. What do you really value in those areas, and making sure that you're working towards, you know, all of those different parts of your identity, not just one. So I think in terms of self-care, that's kind of one of the things that I would say is really foundational.
And what resources and support, Peter, is available to students who may need additional support or advice, particularly around their well-being or mental health, how they're feeling?
There's a number of different things available. I think one of the first things that I would suggest is that students register with student wellbeing, because then that gives access to all sorts of different things. So there are counselling services available within the university, access to one-to-one wellbeing appointments with practitioners who can provide support for a whole range of different wellbeing issues. So things like anxiety and stress, and dealing with those types of things, to low mood and perhaps longer term mental health support as well, if that's something that's required. For perhaps longer term mental health difficulties, we can offer sort of even more support, maybe in the form of like a learning contract. So students might be able to access more practical support, more tangible support for teaching. So attending lectures and seminars, or for their assignments or for exams. So there's all sorts of different services that are available within the university for students looking for support for wellbeing issues. And the student wellbeing webpage is also really good, because there's links to things like the Samaritans and the Mix and Shout and a range of other mental health services. So for anybody who's in need of perhaps more urgent help, there's a whole bunch of different links on there and different resources that people can access.
And I think it's also just worth discussing a little bit around, you know, it's kind of linked to imposter syndrome and kind of this fear of failure, that there's still this perception that if we make ourselves vulnerable and we ask for help and we say we're not okay, that actually that's also a weakness. So what advice would you give to our listeners who need a bit of support and are reluctant to do so?
I think, you know, first of all, it's about understanding that you maybe you're not really alone in this. You know, we talked about how imposter syndrome is very prevalent among a number of different groups. So I think understanding that absolutely people aren't alone with their well-being struggles is important. And again, it's really easy for me to say, oh, well, you should speak to somebody about it. But you really should, whether it's a friend or a relative or just somebody else, you know, somebody on your course or maybe a member of staff that you're comfortable with or you've, you know, have a good relationship with. You know, I think speaking about these things is easier said than done. But I think, you know, if we are, and we can start this, you know, even if we've got a good level of mental well-being, a good level of mental health, we can still have those conversations around mental health and we can start to normalize them so that in those times when maybe we are struggling a little bit, it's not so big a reach to speak out and just to speak to somebody about it.
And I just want to focus a little bit more on positive action and kind of moving forward. So I know that you'd said, Peter, that a lot of the imposter syndrome is actually about the barriers and the situations we're in. It's not actually something that we've created for ourselves. But just want to talk a little bit about pushing through comfort zones and kind of just the understanding of actually it's okay to fail. Could you talk to us a little bit about that and kind of, you know, your experiences around that?
Yeah, again, I think it's a cultural expectation, isn't it, that everything's rosy and everything's perfect. And again, you know, I don't want to be the person who sits and blames social media, but there's a lot of stuff, isn't there, on social media. We curate our lives to present everything that's positive and everything that goes well. And we don't talk about all of the failures that we experience on a day-to-day basis, on a monthly basis, on a yearly basis. You know, we don't present those as the kind of major things that happen in our lives. So there is a hesitance to talk about failure, to normalize failure. But, you know, I think that it's important to do that. It's important to experience failure as an opportunity for learning about, okay, well, where can we do better? Where can we improve? Where are the things that I can change based on this? So it's using that failure almost as feedback. But again, you know, we're in this and I see this on a day-to-day basis with some of my students. When they're perhaps submitting a piece of work for the first time, there's this almost, I hesitate to say perfectionism because it's not quite that, but there's this sort of desire to make sure that it's you know, it's going to be a first. It's going to be this amazing piece of work. And really the purpose of these assignments is that it's a learning experience. It's all about learning, you know, so it's about doing the thing to the best of your ability. Do I think that I've, you know, followed the assignment brief? Do I think that I've done this piece of work to the best of my capabilities? Do I feel like I've done what I'm supposed to be doing? Be brave, you know, submit that piece of work, give that presentation, you know, go to that interview. And then, you know, understand that it's all a learning process, a learning opportunity. But if we don't do the follow-up, the evaluation, then we're missing that opportunity to learn from failure. So seeing it as feedback, as an opportunity to learn, it's almost reframing that failure as you know, something positive, is perhaps the way to approach it.
And I'm just mindful, Peter, that we're coming to the end of our time together. But if you were to give our listeners a piece of advice that they could take with them on their journey when they're having self-doubt or they're struggling, what thought of the day would you give to them to kind of always remember and draw back on?
Oh, thought for the day. Well, I think I would come back to this idea. Well, a couple of ideas, really. The first one is this idea of common humanity. You know, we talk about self-compassion and self-kindness, you know, making sure that we're treating ourselves the same way that we would treat somebody else. And a big part of that is this idea of common humanity, which is understanding that other people, most other people, are probably going through the same sorts of things that you are. Okay, so understanding that actually, you know, the world that we see on social media and the world that's presented to us as being absolutely perfect, it's not really true. So understanding that you're not alone is really, really important. And the second thing is that I would come back to this idea of understanding that thoughts aren't the truth. The, you know, our mind likes to give us loads and loads of thoughts a day, and some of them are helpful, some of them are not helpful. Can we start to just take almost a step back? So rather than being caught up in our thoughts and kind of arguing with ourselves about our thoughts, can we just almost take a step back, like as if we're observing them, as if we're watching our thoughts just kind of pass by? And like I say, we can see that some of them are helpful and some of them are less helpful, but they all kind of just come and sit there for a while and then disappear. And if we can see all of our thoughts that way, then again, it just allows us to detach from this idea that our thoughts are the truth. And that's a long way to dealing with some of that imposter syndrome that we kind of started by talking about.
Peter, thank you so much for joining us on the Aspire podcast. I could talk to you all day and I feel like I've been in a therapy session. So thank you so much for joining us. You've been great. And I'm sure our listeners have really benefited from your expertise.
No, thank you for having me.
Sheffield Hallam University is one of UK's largest and most diverse universities, with a community of around 37,000 students. The university's mission is simple: they transform lives. Sheffield Hallam is an award-winning university, recently receiving gold in the Teaching Excellence Framework for outstanding support for student access and progression. Individuals from all backgrounds are provided with the opportunity to acquire skills, knowledge, and experience to succeed at whatever they choose to do.